step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lady Justice is a true crime podcast. Therefore, deals with incidents of violence, disturbing imagery, and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. The Lady Justice podcast wishes to offer their deepest condolences to the victims' families and wishes to offer thanks to those that work in emergency services. Hello, my lovelies, and welcome to another episode of Lady Justice, a true crime podcast. Lady Justice is a weekly podcast that covers fascinating cases from both the past and the present. My name is Chantelle, and I'm your friendly true crime junkie with slight caffeine addiction issues. I hope this episode finds you all feeling brilliant and that you've had a fantastic week. As usual, before I get into this episode, I do want to ask you guys a huge favour. Please support this podcast by subscribing, rating, and leaving a review where you can. And because sharing is caring, I do want you to tell everyone you know. Share it on social media and get the word out. It makes the world of difference. If you'd like to contact me about anything at all, then please feel free to do so via any of the show's social media or by my email, which you'll find in the show notes. I would also like to take the time to remind you that the biggest true crime weekend is coming to London in June 2021. CrimeCon UK in partnership with Crime and Investigation. I am so excited to be attending the event as a podcaster on Podcast Row. Listeners of the show can get an exclusive discount on ticket prices with the code LADY, which will give you 10% off. Now, CrimeCon have sold all of their early bird tickets, but they're being very, very lovely and keeping the prices set at the early bird ticket price up until January 1st, 2021, when the tickets will rise in cost. So if you want to come along and you want to get the best discount you can, now's the time to buy one. This week, before the act of kindness, the promo is for Active Shooter, which has long been on my podcast subscriptions. Focusing on mass shooting crimes, it's respectful yet riveting storytelling, and the host JT really brings together the analysis of the motives behind some of the most notorious crimes. You can hear more from Active Shooter a little later in the show. Now, in this week's episode, two women on the very edge of society were to disappear without a trace 18 months apart. But were they the only victims? This is the case, Missed Chances. Just as an extra trigger warning here, this episode deals with child sexual abuse, rape, violence against women, substance abuse, and forced marriage. Only continue with this episode if you feel like you can. Support information will be provided in the show notes. So, without further ado, here is some background on the location and timeframe of this case. We are heading back to the year 2020, because let's face it, 2020 has felt like a decade. Boris Johnson is still in his first year of his premiership, and the world has become a very odd place. Face masks are the must-have accessory. The UK has been placed into two national lockdowns, and the internet has never been so essential, all down to COVID-19. Famous folk who have passed so far this year include psychic Derek Acora, Sean Connery, and Des O'Connor. We're taking a trip to Canning Town in East London. Once part of the Essex Marshland, it was developed into a dockland and residential area during the early Victorian period. Famous folk with connections to the area include Jeremy Kyle, Danny Dyer, and David Essex. As always, all my sources will be listed in the show notes. At the age of 17, a young man named Saeed Yonis, living in East London, was to start to show the man he was becoming. It was 2001 and he'd begun to date a girl, just a year younger. She first took his early behaviours as inexperienced and protective affection. He would pick her up from home and walk her to college. The teenagers would spend increasing time together. She would later speak to how he seemed to be very attentive and paid me lots of attention. Then things began to change. Yonis began to become overbearing, and as the young woman would say, he displayed an quite extreme paranoia about me looking at other men. That is, simply put, abuse. The abuse escalated. He would violently attack her whilst they were out and about. The violence was not just emotional or physical. At just 16, the girl was faced with sexual abuse from her boyfriend. Saeed Yonis was to, on one occasion, lock the young woman in a cupboard, refusing to let her out until she agreed his demands. Sex. The young woman fell pregnant. Her family were deeply worried for the teenager, and despite warnings, she was in a situation that she seemed not to be able to remove herself from. Until she, as a pregnant young woman, was to be attacked by the father of her unborn child, yet again. Saeed called the girl's mother, shouting about what, in his pathetic opinion, her daughter really was, and telling her that the girl would be lucky to get home that day. Thankfully, the 16-year-old girl was able to return to her family, and she blocked him from her life. She had a beautiful child and set up a home with the support of professionals and her family. As her child grew, she eased into life as a mother, yet one day she answered the door to a past she would have happily forgotten. Saeed Yonis, with his pierced ears and designer clothes, stood before her. She had no idea how the man had tracked her, and before she could close the door, she was shocked as his hand was wrapped around her throat. He met his child for the first time and threatened the young mother's life with the fact that he planned to take the child to Pakistan. The ordeal was to be over as soon as it began, as the brave woman contacted the police. She was then rehoused for her safety. After she was rehoused, she was not to be contacted by officers again, and she did her best to move on with her life. Yonis was a father, still in his teens, but it was not his child he was paying attention to. Within his own home located in London, he had begun to spend time with a 12-year-old. This can be dated back to late 2002 to early 2003, when the man was just 18 to 19 years old. He was not spending time with the 12-year-old with an innocent intention. At such a young age, when a girl's life should be about school and friends and the latest crazes, she was instead subjected to daily violence by the man, who blamed the child for his actions. He would again, doing as he did with his previous girlfriend, lock the girl into a small cupboard for her bad behaviour, as described by his very warped judgment. She was unable to speak with her family. Yonis dictated what she could and could not say to her own parents. By the time she was 14, the girl was taken to a mosque in the East London borough of Walthamstow to attend a ceremony she had little to no idea about. Terrified of the much older man, she agreed and followed along, yet as a child who was not from an Islamic background, she was alien to the actual events happening around her. She was told to repeat the words of the imam, which were in Arabic, and at the end, she was told that they had just completed their marriage before Allah. The girl's family were beside themselves as their little girl frequented their family home less and less often, and they then reported the child missing. Police attended the home of Yonis, a known acquaintance of the girl, to find that she was there. After speaking with the girl and admitting what had been happening in hers and her adult boyfriend's relationship, Saeed Yonis was arrested. The teenager would later say that at the wedding she didn't know what she was repeating, and after being asked why she had not reported any of the abuse she had suffered, she stated, "Because I thought he would get away with it." This young girl was again a victim of abuse by a man who was honing his skills at finding vulnerable and often young targets. Police were to charge Saeed in 2005 with assault, false imprisonment and sexual activity with a child. He was remanded to prison to await trial. However, the conceited Yonis was not to heed any warning about not contacting his young victim that he had spent almost 3 years grooming. He would continue to contact her, drifting between being charming and vile towards her. The trial would somehow lead to Saeed Yonis being acquitted, and upon his immediate release, he tracked down the young girl and started to sexually abuse her once again. The child became pregnant as a result of this. With the support of her family, she would make a fresh complaint about the man to the Met Police. This was not the only complaint that had been made at this point in time being made against Yonis. Another young teenage girl had also been subjected to the same types of violence and maltreatment. This led the Crown Prosecution Service, or the CPS, charging Yonis with a total of 26 offences. The trial was to begin in early 2007. It began with the second young victim giving evidence in front of the judge. This evidence was not deemed to be strong enough by the trial judge, and they ordered that Saeed was to be cleared of the charges in relation to her. The prosecution in this case was not to offer evidence on some of the other charges, mainly relating to assault and sexual activity with a child, and therefore 20 of those 26 charges were dropped. Yonis pleaded guilty on the charges relating to sexual offences and assault against the young girl he'd forced into marriage. The trial judge was to sentence Saeed to a total of 30 months imprisonment, reduced by the time he'd already, at the time of conviction, spent on remand. He was also to register as a sexual offender, with both the police and the probation service monitoring him for the duration of the order. At the time of Saeed's release from prison, he was assessed using the Risk Matrix 2000, which is a static risk assessment based on historical factors shown to be statistically predictive of future sexual offending. Determining factors could categorise an offender into certain levels, that being very high, medium, or low risk. In 2007, when he was released, Saeed was placed as a medium-risk offender and was subject to many restrictions, including a sexual offender protection order, which banned him from having contact with any person or persons under the age of 16. As I say, it's now 2007, and Yonis was released from prison. It was at this time he was once again housed in East London. A 17-year-old girl was the next in his horrendous pattern of victims. This young woman had come from a respected Muslim family who had recently lost the father of the household. The girl was taken in by the charming man who seemed very affectionate and understood her issues. She practiced her religion but had chosen, with her family's support, not to wear religious clothing. Soon enough, that was to change, and not for the right reasons for her. Soon after being drawn into the relationship with Saeed, she was submitted to even more violence than the known victims of Yonis. The young woman was subjected to long, repeated, sadistic rapes. She was attacked with items such as kitchen knives, hammers, and barbecue forks. She'd been burnt with a lighter, blistering her flesh, and at one point had been thrown from a window, resulting in a triple arm fracture. She was once imprisoned and made to beg for forgiveness in a public telephone box for trying to call her family home. She was forbid to be allowed outside without him chaperoning her, and he would often threaten to throw her in front of a train. The young woman began to wear a burqa in order to hide her wounds and protect her family from the sight. In Islamic culture, the burqa is normally worn only from when in the company of men, and is generally considered to be okay to remove when in the company of female relatives. For this young woman, however, she chose to wear her burqa even when visiting her mother and sisters, which alerted her family to know that there's something not quite right with the once bubbly and fun teen. One day, courage prevailed, and in front of her mother and sister, she was to remove her religious clothing. Her sister was to later say, "It was the worst image I have ever seen in my life." The young woman in question spoke to how she gained that courage, later saying, "In my heart, I kept praying. I felt like God answered my prayers and my mum came into my house." She was taken to the police, who were to escort the teenager to have her injuries examined by a doctor. More than 70 different wounds were on her body. Yonis was to be arrested. Now, here comes another infuriating mischance. 5 charges had been placed against Saeed Yonis relating to this victim. He was to get a defence counsel who were able to help the accused man gain a plea deal. Yonis agreed to admit guilt to 3 of the charges on a reduced basis, those being grievous bodily harm, assault occasioning bodily harm, and unlawful wounding. The 2 other charges were for rape and sexual assault. And please remember, at this point, Saeed is a registered sex offender. They were left to lie on file. Now, to lie on file in the UK means that the judge has agreed that there is enough evidence for the charge to bring a conviction. However, they will not proceed with such, as it would not be to the public interest to do so. This usually happens when a defendant has admitted guilt in other more serious crimes. I'm not too sure if that's what's happened in this case, because in my opinion, rape is very serious. The victim was not informed of the deal until after it had been agreed via the courts. Yonis was then sentenced to less than 5 years in 2008, the judge agreeing to what Yonis had told in evidence was the correct version of events. And as I say, the victim was not informed, therefore could not give evidence. It was also at the same time that this case had come to the attention of the police that another case involving a young teenage girl and Saeed was to be investigated. She had come forward to police and made a formal complaint stating that she had also been a victim of false imprisonment and assaults using weapons such as a hammer and a crowbar. The police did investigate, yet these attacks had occurred about 6 years previously, so no action was taken on the advice of the CPS. Let's just for now leave that scumbag to rot in a prison cell for the time being. It's 2008 and he's got just under 5 years. We are now going to the city of Miskolc in northern Hungary, where in 1984 Henriette Szulcs was born to Maria. She was a happy child with a passion for art and writing. She was warm and loving and started to settle into a normal, happy life, getting married and enjoying parenthood with her husband. Unfortunately, the relationship was to break down and she left her home country in search for a happy and settled life that could help provide her stability. The lone woman left in the late 2000s and she made her way to Germany, where she spent a number of years. However, without her children, her mental health began to decline, and she fell into a crowd of bad people, those who look out for others' desperation. Henny, as she was known by those that knew her, was to reappear again in 2012, when she was to enter the UK. As part of the European Union, or the EU, it was perfectly legal. However, the circumstances surrounding her arrival were not. Henny, at her lowest moment, had been the victim of sex trafficking and was being used. She was helpless as she was forced to undertake sex work to pay for her transport, and she was made to work in the East London region. The sex work was to lead to another pregnancy, one in which she left to return to Hungary for the duration. A wise and wholly more brave woman than I, she then gave her baby up for adoption. Life was only to get tougher for the woman who had already fallen on some incredibly hard times. She met a Hungarian man who, in 2014, she was to relocate with to the city of Birmingham in the West Midlands. At first, all seemed well until this man took Henriette's passport and birth certificate and left her in the city, unable to support herself without her documentation. She was able to make her way to the capital once again, having some acquaintances in the city. She then fell into another abusive relationship that drew her onto the cold streets. As tough as life had become, the obstacles the young woman had been through, she was determined to make a positive life for herself in her adopted country. She reached out to a charity that worked with those that slept rough, called the Welcome Centre in Ilford. The day centre provided support and clear opportunities for those to rebuild their lives. Henny was actively turning her life around, so much so she appeared in a local newspaper, the Ilford Reporter, about the work of the Welcome Centre. She was due to start a college course and she shared in all the group activities. Those that knew her from the group would say, she didn't speak much about the difficulties of rough sleeping and homelessness, preferring to be on the positive side. Henny was an artist. She loved to share her artwork that were colourful and filled with butterflies. It was in part how she coped with the extreme trauma of her life. Despite her growing chances in life, she was still extremely vulnerable as the spring of 2015 came around. She was yet again to fall for a man who took advantage of her kind soul. This man, who she referred to as her pimp when she was to make an appearance at the centre, had forced her into sex work. She was beaten regularly and she had become addicted to drugs. She was a woman in complete parallel to who she was just months before, and it made a much bigger impact than anyone could have expected. As with this lifestyle change came a missed chance to save Henny from the life that kept hold of her. Months before she had fallen into the circle of her pimp, with the support of those trying to help her change her life for the better, she had contacted the Metropolitan Police in regards to a rape that occurred in February 2015. The rape had been committed by a man that had known connections with the woman, the police having attended on four separate occasions when the former partner had assaulted Henriette. His name was David Dallison. Yet, for some reasons unknown, and that can only be speculated, the CPS immediately refused to authorise the rape charge against the accused, and therefore, Dallison was released on police bail. Later the charge was authorised, but due to the fact that Henny was now back sleeping rough, no one, including the police, were able to contact her, and the case was dropped. Henny, on the fringes of society, continued to survive. In January of 2016, an incident was to happen at an Ilford block tower, which put into perspective how much the young woman's life had changed. She had been thrown off a fifth-floor balcony of the home of Dallison, and the police believed it was attempted murder. She had suffered terribly due to the fall and sustained multiple injuries to her ribs and shoulder. When she was able to speak to police, she spoke of the attack before, and a charge of attempted murder was brought against her former partner, who was once again charged with that rape. This was the time for a change. She focused on her art and writing whilst recovering and accepted the help and support of adult services, who wished as much as she did for her to land on her feet. She'd been offered a place in a safe house that specialised in those who had been victims of sex trafficking and modern slavery, though it would have meant a relocation to the city of Bristol. And although she had made friends with some fellow patients at the ward, she accepted the offer, giving her new acquaintances her new telephone number. One of her new friends was a man who was also receiving treatment in the same hospital. He went by the nickname Boxer, due to his love of the sport, or Ali, after the heavyweight great. He seemed to take a shine to the pretty brunette, and they spoke on the phone as often as possible. Within a few weeks, she requested permission from the staff to visit the capital to visit her new friend, whom she was becoming ever increasingly emotionally attached to. Seeing the positive effect the friendship was having, it was agreed that she could go on day trips to London. However, on at least two occasions, this was deemed to be a bad idea, as the staff had to officially report her as a missing person because she returned to the facility too late. The friendship was now on the cusp of being a relationship, as Boxer began to suggest that she could try and make a life with him, saying he would support her recovery and that he had serious thoughts about marrying the creative woman. She spoke with the trained staff about the man, giving examples of his loving behaviour and stated that she was lucky to have finally found a man who did not show abusive traits and that he had her best interests at heart. She was going to leave the refuge in Bristol, and although her new love was unwilling to share his address details with the charity or police, she left in March 2016 to be with a man she'd met by chance just 2 months before. Now, I want to illustrate how beautiful and talented a soul this woman, no matter how troubled she was, had. Left behind from her days being supported by the numerous agencies are a number of her drawings and writings, and I want to read some of them now, that shows that no matter how hard life kicked Henny, how she'd hoped for a better life. Let me tell you something about how I feel for you. Really love you, and I mean it. Bottom of my heart, to the stars and back. I don't want to lose you, and I won't ever let that happen. This is true. I just want to love you. This is in stark contrast to what she wrote between the months of March and September 2016, when after moving in with Boxer, her love for him turned into self-destruction, as she doubted herself in his world. These are just extracts of what she wrote during this period. "We'll learn more to keep my mouth shut when I need to listen, and to talk up when I need. Boxer doesn't want to know what Henriette wants. Keep distance away from Boxer, follow the things point to point what he says. Give him space and show him respect. How can love turn into hatred just like that? Everything you promised is no more than a shattered dream. I got disillusioned as a result of some really big slaps in the face. When I admitted my sins, you judged and expelled me from the inner circle and planted poison in my broken heart that was anyway stone cold by then. This poison has been tormenting and burning me. I'm afraid of dying and I don't want to hate you." This shows how much Boxer was not the Prince Charming that Henny not only wanted, but needed. The refuge she had previously lived in received no contact from her, and no welfare checks could be completed as Boxer did not give his address to the services supporting the woman, now in her early 30s. During this time, in June, the court case against her previous partner, Dallison, was due to start at Snaresbrook Crown Court. Police officers had tried to contact Henriette to no avail, and a few days after it was due to start, they finally received a text message stating she was too unwell to attend. The Crown Prosecution Service applied for a delay in the case. However, the judge refused and the case was dismissed. Officers tried to ring Henny after she reached out, yet no reply was ever to be received. The lack of contact was now a tendency linked to Henny. Her former friends in East London didn't even know she was back in the city. In fact, she was just a stone's throw away in Canning Town. But this was not by her. This was Boxer. He was isolating the woman, ensuring she had as little contact with the outside world as possible. She was made to be his personal slave, only allowed out with him. August of 2016 was the last time anyone remembers seeing Henriette. She was arguing with a man in the street that was subsequently broken up by the police. The man was to receive a penalty notice for cannabis possession, and the couple left together. Now, London is a diverse and rich community with pockets of tight-knit groups. One of these is the Turkish community. From this came the Mustafa family, a large family of strong women and protective men. Mary Can, or Jan as her family called her, or Mary Jane, or MJ as some of her friends knew her, was part of this family. She was a loved child and she was always close to her mother and extended family. She was always smiling, always ready to help, and grew up to be a determined young woman. Jan had three children that she worked part-time in retail to support. She spoke to her family daily. She loved life. This sometimes, though, just isn't enough for the universe to give us. Jan was to suffer a relationship breakdown during her 30s that brought a deep depression. But she tried to hide it from those that she loved and made the best life she could for her children. Jan, who had never even smoked in her life previously, wrote in one of her 60 diary entries found by her family years later, spoke to her pain and how she had begun to self-medicate with drugs in an attempt to feel better about life, which for a while it did. But as her tolerance grew, the need for more to give the same effect came into play. During her early days, she was fully capable of hiding her new emerging addiction, even from her own mother. She was able to take care of her three young children, until one day, she could no more. Becoming dependent on any substance is not a lifestyle choice. It is a chemical reaction. No one wants to be addicted to anything. No one chooses to have to supplement their life with altering substances or gambling or even things such as excessive gaming. This is not really about control. And the women in this case, both Henriette and Jan, were victims of circumstance. This again is proven by Jan's private belongings discovered by her family. Jan did not want to live her life like this. She wanted help. She wanted rehab. Jan was to pen a letter to the ITV morning show, which is no longer aired, Jeremy Kyle, requesting help for her addiction she had succumbed to. However, she did not send it. Her children moved in with Jan's mother and settled into life, with Jan keeping very regular contact and expressing her affection for them. I will stress here that her personal issues did not change her core humanity. She was still a daughter, a sister, and a mother. The desperations that go hand in hand with addictions ravished the young mother as she slowly fell in with a bad crowd. That underground drug scene introduced her to many a shady character. Because she knew how much pain she was inflicting on those she loved, she chose to sleep rough instead of relying on her family. The new acquaintances were to sometimes let her sleep on their sofas, and life was unrecognisable. She had become extremely vulnerable to those around her, and she relied on the kindness of others to survive. One of these was an associate by the name of Boxer, who lived close to her family home in Canning Town and told Jan he was a singer-songwriter. She would visit his one-bedroom flat and they would often speak on the phone. He seemed warm and caring, and she grew attached to him for support. During the early months of 2018, almost 18 months after Henny had come to stay with Boxer, Jan was to get into a fight with the friends she'd been crashing at. She visited some family and they recalled later that she seemed scared. On May 3rd, she attended her mother's home. It was just days before her daughter's 11th birthday and she asked her mum if she could borrow £20. She explained the situation. She said she needed the money to retrieve her clothes from the hostel. Family members offered to drive her and collect her clothing, but she said she needed that money. She was starting to get upset. Reluctantly, thinking that the money would be used on Jan's drug addiction, she was given a £20 note. She left with that money and just £3 on her mobile phone in her handbag. The family were upset, but they always left the door open for her and knew that she would be back for her daughter's birthday, and prayed that she just stayed safe until then. On the day of her daughter's birthday, Jan never showed. Despite her issues, her children were her whole world, and the family instantly knew something was wrong. Her daughter was to pen a letter to her mother that day. "To Mummy, please come back. I really miss you. You missed my 11th birthday party. It was the worst party ever. I sat in the corner crying my eyes out looking at your pictures and reading your poems while in my head screaming, 'Where are you? Please, Mum, come back home.'" On May 10th, the Mustafa family were to contact the Met Police and report Jan as a missing person. The missing person investigation that was led at the time was later to be subject to an internal Scotland Yard inquiry. So you can already tell how that went. It is often the case that those just on the fringes are forgotten. The community did support the Mustafa family as they took matters into their own hands. They fundraised and produced posters that would be placed on Deliveroo vehicles. They spoke to everybody in the street, and they tried to contact every news media they could to get coverage about the loved woman. All the known acquaintances were passed to the police, with Boxer being spoken to. They spoke with him in June of 2018, yet he claimed only to know Jan in passing, a friend of a friend. As they walked back down the long corridor, they passed a Currys-branded cardboard box for a chest freezer. They left, and that was that. Later, the family were to be passed evidence that showed the police had done very little with the information that they had been supplied with. Jan's telephone number was not traced, and if it was, it would have shown that the SIM card had been used to contact Boxer both in late April and early May, when she disappeared. The evidence showed that if police had investigated properly, it would have also shown that via triangulation of the signal, the phone had been used in the area of Boxer's one-bedroom home. The investigation ran by Jane's family would start to slow, as leads would often show to be false. No one knew what happened to Jan. She just dropped off the face of the earth. Boxer would end up going to prison for a time at the end of 2018 after he assaulted a police officer. There was no follow-up attempt to know if he had contact with Jan. After Boxer was released from prison, he was to start to spend less time at his home. The flat was slowly falling into disrepair, the white washing machine having black tape holding the door on. He visited a neighbour during April of 2019. He told her he was on tough times, and the woman, aged 91, appreciated the company. He spun her a story that he'd been homeless and said he had just moved into his home. She gave him $1,400 of her savings just to get him on his feet. She was unaware he was stealing money from a jam jar she kept in a kitchen cupboard. £60 was eventually taken. Boxer, a man in his mid-30s, was due to attend her home late in April. But after a few days with him not appearing, the lady concerned for his welfare was to call the police. Boxer lived at number 34 Fandome Close, in a ground floor flat with a red door. The police first attended the property on April 25th and received no answer, and then again on the 26th of April 2019. When police arrived shortly before 8:30 a.m, they rapped on the door, yet received no answer from inside. Officers then went to the front of the building and located a boarded-up window that was easy access for the two officers. They entered a bathroom with a broken toilet, a bucket on the floor being used as the disposal method for waste. They called out, identifying themselves and asking for anyone in the property to make themselves known. The bare flat had dirty pots lining the kitchen sides and white walls. The bedroom was filled with rubbish and no bed to be seen. The blue corner sofa in the living room had clearly been used as the place to sleep. No one was home, and one officer exited the property to speak with passerbys, and the other examined the property. Body cam footage shows them opening a small cupboard door near to the door of the bathroom, opposite the bedroom. No electricity was on in the home, and flies were buzzing inside the dark closet. The smoke alarm battery alert was periodically beeping as they moved the simmer frame from on top of the white freezer, when they noticed a padlock. Worried for the resident's safety, a crowbar was fetched and attempts were made to break the lock. When a small gap was made, a light from a torch showed a foot wearing a grey superhero branded sock. Forensics were called and the home was sealed. The freezer was taken to be x-rayed. A distressing discovery was made, however. It wasn't just one body in the freezer. A second body was laid under the first. The bodies had suffered decomposition, which was to make identification difficult. The body closest to the top had distinctive tattoos, which, along with DNA, showed that it was the body of mother of three, Jan Mustafa, last seen alive on May 3rd the previous year. The second body, after months of searching and DNA evidence being supplied by her family in Hungary, was identified as Henriette Scooge, last seen alive during August of 2016. No one had even reported her missing. The home on Fandome Close was well known to officers. The man who resided there was known not just for assaulting a police officer, but for a criminal history that stretched back many years. He was known not only just as Boxer or Ali, he was known as Saeed Yonis. It took almost 4 days for police to track down the man, and he was arrested in the area of W10 getting into a taxi. He was to tell the arresting officers, "It's my house, it's my problem, no one else is involved." Saeed was originally charged with obstructing a coroner and unlawful burial. The crime scene was secured, and inside it told a story of a man who clearly wasn't telling the investigators everything. Inside the piles of hoarded items located in the bedroom were items that belonged to both Henny and Jan. Jan's handbag, including her mobile phone, had been shoved inside an Asda supermarket bag for life, and some of her writings had been discovered. Henriette had clearly also been at the property with pages of her distinctive artwork depicting angels, wings and praying hands had been found. Scrap paper told of her mental journey whilst there, with writings of how she was becoming ever increasingly depressed at her living situation. Blood was also discovered in the home, despite Saeed having all the carpets within the home removed sometime in May or June 2018, and then being replaced with wooden flooring. The carpets were stored in his shed. Fingerprints of Jan had been discovered on the oven in the property almost a year after she disappeared. More evidence came to light that showed how horrific the situation was in reality. On the 11th of April 2019, just a fortnight before the gruesome discovery by officers was made, an electrical engineer had to visit the property due to the electric being offline, as Saeed had a debt. Yonis was to answer the door with an air freshener canister in his hand, and before opening the door to the cupboard that included the meter for the electric, as well as the freezer in which the bodies were found, he was to spray it. It did jack shit to cover the smell. In fact, it was the second time the electric had been cut off for a significant amount of time, the third being when officers had come to do the welfare check. The freezer was examined and more than one post-mortem was conducted on the bodies of Jan and Henny. So bad were their injuries and the body decay that no official cause of death could be recorded. Henriette had all but one rib broken, and the coroner believes she had suffered for weeks before her death, which may have been caused by Yonis stamping down on her body. Due to the writings found in the property, they believed Henny was killed in November 2016. As her body was removed from the freezer, they found that she was in pyjama bottoms and she had been covered in a sleeping bag and plastic, later determined to be the packaging for the freezer. Jan had also suffered an incredible amount of violence from the pitiful man who held her dead body in his home. It has been considered, yet cannot be confirmed, that Jan was to suffer substantial pressure on her neck, yet she also had numerous ribs fractured. It would take until February 2020 for forensic evidence to be strong enough for the courts to formally charge Saeed Yonis with murder. That's a whole 10 months since the discovery. Saeed Yonis's trial was to be held at Southwark Crown Court, with Mrs. Justice Chima Grubb presiding. His first appearance in Court 1 was on the 27th of July 2020, until the trial was halted for a few days on the 3rd of August, up until the 10th. It was to last until September 2020. For the Crown, Duncan Penny, Queen's Counsel, was to say that Saeed was a violent and controlling man who killed both Henriette and Jan before hiding them in a freezer. Evidence was heard by witnesses who had seen the victims with Yonis, including a shopkeeper who saw Jan with the accused just before she disappeared. Other links to Yonis being in a shady situation, especially in the time of Jan's disappearance, included data from a motivational WhatsApp group the now 35-year-old had been part of. The defendant sent a message in that group. A girl was in his flat giving him a hard time and he wanted to get rid of her. Penny then told the jury of the group's replies to Yonis's request, with many saying to call the police, yet some teased him for his situation. The police outlined that before the disappearance of Henny, Saeed was to contact the police on 26 occasions to make complaints. Yet after, this was greatly reduced and he was edgy when officers visited his home in relation to the mandatory checks outlined as he was a registered sex offender. Police officers had interviewed him in his home when Henriette was in the freezer. The exhibits at the trial also included the receipt for the chest freezer, bought at the Beckton branch of Currys. He had paid with cash in November 2016 and had collected the item instead of having the heavy item delivered. This is also in part why police believe that Henriette had died in November and not in the summer in which she was last seen. Evidence from the store was to show that he had given the name and address of a former school friend for contact details. He had not spoken to that individual since 2006. Yonis' defence was finally prepared by Ica Pert, Queen's Counsel, after he'd gone through many defence solicitors beforehand, either due to refusing advice or just firing them. Saeed had not told the police or the prosecution what the basis of his defence was for almost a year. He had waited until he knew the full story that was going to be presented by the prosecution. Saeed gave evidence, saying that he was a victim of circumstance and that he had never killed the women. He had found both of them dead and concealed their bodies after he worried that he would be suspected due to his criminal history. He told the jury that despite what he'd done in the past, he was now, quote, a decent guy. He couldn't keep up that decent guy routine in court, however, as he would shout abuse at the women who gave evidence against him, including three of his ex-partners. Saeed showed no remorse. He then started to decline to leave Belmarsh Prison, where he had been held on remand. The judge declared the trial could be heard in his absence. This case was heard without the family of Henny being able to attend due to the international travel restrictions because of COVID-19, but the family of Jan did attend daily. They were there when the jury came back and declared that Saeed Yonis was guilty on all counts. Saeed was not to attend his sentencing, but it was still read by the judge. She spoke to the beauty and creativity of the victims and the braveness of his surviving victims in their testimony against him. She then gave the sentences on the four charges. The sentence is 5 years imprisonment on each, concurrent to the sentence for murder. On the two counts of murder, the sentence is life imprisonment with a concurrent minimum term of 38 years. She then continued, "You may never be released. That will only occur if and when the parole board is satisfied that it is no longer necessary for the protection of the public that you should be confined. Even if eventually released, you will remain on license and subject to recall to prison to continue serving these life sentences for the remainder of your life." After the trial was concluded, remarks were made by Jan's family to the waiting press. In part, what they said is as follows. She was a gentle being who still had her whole life ahead of her to live and to watch her children grow. My heart deeply goes out to her children, who are the strongest people that I know. The grief that they are going through compares to no other pain. Our family have lost a precious jewel. My Aunt Mary Mustafa was an incredible aunt, mother, sister and daughter to her family. Jan was a fantastic mother. She adored her children. She loved to dance. She was artistic. She was creative. She was beautiful. She was friends with everybody and very funny. She celebrated life. She was optimistic. She never said anything bad about anybody. She gave her last penny to someone in need. She was an angel. She is an angel. The trial is over. Justice has been done. Closure, they say. Never. It will not bring my Jan back. As mentioned, Henny's family were unable to attend the trial in London, but a press release was published by the Met Police which stated, "Maria, Henriette's mother, has been hugely overwhelmed by the death of her daughter, not only because she was murdered, but because it happened in another country. A country where she does not know the law or know the police investigation and court processes. Maria lost touch with Henriette when she came to the UK. The fact that Henriette lay deceased in a freezer for 2.5 years with no one looking for her or realising she was missing, torments Maria on a daily basis. Her inner turmoil she suffers is, as you would expect for a mother mourning the death of her child, and to make matters worse, she hasn't been able to see her or lay her to rest. This is most unimaginable for any family member, but particularly a mother. In the Hungarian press, Maria was photographed with her husband. She spoke of Henny's children, now aged 13 and 15, and their emotional struggle. Maria said that she would have gone back to work as a city cleaner, even through her bad health, if that meant she could have afforded to bring her daughter home to be laid to rest in her home country. However, the price of such would have been too much. It was devastating to her family that Henriette was to be buried in England and they could not visit her grave. And that wraps up the end of this case. It's a very, very shocking case to me that there were so many missed chances. And it angers me that this would have been completely different if the victim's circumstances were different. Let me know what your thoughts are on social media. It's now time for our promo, which comes from one of the show's friends, Active Shooter.
We have an active shooter. We have an active shooter inside the warehouse.
Welcome to Active Shooter, a podcast that covers the whys, the hows, and the aftermath of active shooter events. We will delve into the lives interrupted by domestic terrorists. We will investigate the background of the shooter, and together discuss ways in which they can be stopped or even prevented in the future. We will also discuss the failures of our mental health system.
Building, a second call says they are being attacked.
I've been shot.
169, same agent, we got shots fired. 415 AS, Route 291, sounded like an automatic firearm.
But appears to be shots fired.
We will look at the media responses and discover together how they may have inadvertently inspired and contributed to the rise of the mass shootings.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter, active shooter,
active shooter, mass casualty incidents.
This is not a political podcast, nor a podcast about gun control. This is a podcast that studies the psychology behind active shooters, and how and why they make the decisions they have made to take the lives of innocent people.
I love you, it's gonna be fine. Can you hide somewhere? Can you play dead?
Welcome to Active Shooter. Thank you for listening.
All you need to do, as ever, to support the show can be found in the show notes. So don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review them, as well as follow them on all social media. That brings us towards the end of the episode, but before I close up, I would like to see if we can balance out those scales somewhat with a small act of kindness. This week, my suggestion is very personal to me. The reason why I have not uploaded any episode for the past few weeks comes due to my two-year-old being taken into hospital via an ambulance. It was an incredibly scary situation for the both of us. We didn't have any of his belongings, and staff provided us with a TLC bear, which is a small teddy aimed to give comfort to children who were taken into hospital, and are provided across the NHS via a charity. I'm going to leave a link in the show notes that you can donate to get some more TLC bears to NHS services across the country. They really do make a huge difference. So with that, go be good people, go be kind, go be safe, and most importantly, go be happy.